This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We've learned that in the president's inner circle, even among hawks like Mike Pompeo, there was an effort to salvage or at least renegotiate the Iran deal up until the last minute. Because whether you like the deal or not, withdrawing from it creates problems on a global scale. The deal itself seemed to be working. In exchange for curbing its nuclear program, Iran got relief from sanctions. But Donald Trump decided to keep the promise he had made all along on the campaign trail.
This was a horrible, one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
The withdrawal will have diplomatic and psychological consequences, not just in the Middle East, but all over the world. Among other things, it will certainly complicate Trump's hope to get a deal done with North Korea. Wendy Sherman could fairly be called the architect of the Iran agreement. She led the United States in six rounds of talks with Iran and other nations, and she's also had firsthand experience of diplomacy with the North Koreans. Sherman went with Madeleine Albright to Pyongyang during the Clinton years. She spoke with Susan Glasser, who recently joined The New Yorker as a staff writer based in Washington.
So the Iran deal in many ways was the capstone of both what you were doing in the U.S. government in this last go-around in the Obama administration. Of course, many people saw it as the signature achievement of President Obama's story. Now, I want you to take people a little bit inside the arduous, painstaking, at times, I'm sure, makes you want to scream, agonizingly slow progress, years of your life and that of many other people it took to get to this deal. So before we talk about the impact of blowing it up, let's talk about how on earth you made it.
I tease that I negotiated inside the administration. I negotiated with the U.S. Congress. I negotiated with think tankers in Washington. I negotiated, of course, with my interagency colleagues. I negotiated with Israel, with the Gulf states, with everybody who had a stake in Iranian oil, Iranian business in the world. And oh, yeah, occasionally I negotiated with Iran. It's an complex process if you do it correctly. And you indeed have to be ready to walk away from the table. And John Kerry, who, of course, led this and towards the end with Secretary Moniz from the Department of Energy, who joined us, brought extraordinary technical expertise. I did this with a core team of 15, but with hundreds, literally hundreds, in the U.S. administration. And Secretary Kerry was ready to walk away from this several times during the negotiation, as was I. But at the end of the day, we got a deal.
You then had President Trump, almost from the very beginning, when he was just candidate, Donald Trump, saying, this is the worst deal ever. You had in Congress enormous resistance from Republicans in the Senate from the very beginning. They were publicly undermining it. You had Tom Cotton, for example, the Arkansas senator who's emerged as a close advisor to Donald Trump, organizing a letter of his colleagues right in the middle of your negotiations, basically saying, don't take them seriously. We're going to undo this. How seriously did you take that as a possibility while you were negotiating it, that it might not stick?
Well, we certainly knew that was a possibility. And my Iranian counterparts would constantly say to me, how do we know you won't undo the deal? And I said, there's no way to know that, just as there's no way for me to know whether you will undo the deal. The deal has to be as good as it possibly can be, so it is durable and sustainable.
That's interesting, though. They were pressing you even at the time.
Absolutely.
Saying America might not be good at its word.
Absolutely.
Is America good for its word?
Well, you know, we are as good as our word, as our politics allow us to be, and the same is true for Iran. It's true for any country.
So you broke your nose at one point yes. in these negotiations. Like, that's kind of reminds me of when my son got a concussion at science camp. How do you break your nose while negotiating with the Iranians? I trust they didn't punch you.
No. So what happened was our delegation room, the United States delegation room, it was on the top floor of the Palais Coburg in Vienna. And we had secure communications equipment there. And the elevator opened up into a foyer and then to a glass conference room. And generally, that glass door was kept open. I was rushing to get to a secure conference call with Secretary Kerry at about 11 p.m. one evening. That door, however, was closed, and I hadn't paid any attention. I went smack into that glass door. Blood all over the place. Some of my male colleagues said, call for an ambulance. Get someone here immediately. I said, clearly none of you are mothers. When your kid bloodies their nose, there's a lot of blood. So get me an ice pack. I put the ice pack on, a lot of Kleenex, had the conference call with Secretary Kerry. He didn't find out about this till months later. I went to, had a CT scan the next day and went to a doctor, an ear, nose, and throat doctor in Vienna. He walked out and said in English, shit happens. So he packed up my nose. I used a lot of good makeup and went on with my work.
You know, you've heard over and over again, President Trump and those who are allied with him call it the worst deal ever, a terrible deal, an awful deal. You heard it at the time. Have you rethought any aspects of this in the wake of where we are now?
Well, look, the president and the opponents now have said because it didn't cover ballistic missiles, it didn't cover their nefarious action. But what everyone needs to understand is when you're in the midst of a negotiation, this deal is 110 pages long. It's filled with technical detail. That if we had had all of those other issues on the table, which, of course, Iran wasn't willing to negotiate, but let's say they were, if you had them all on the table, what it might mean is Iran would say, okay, I'll do something over here on ballistic missiles, but that means I want to keep more centrifuges, or I want to keep this underground facility on enrichment. So you're negotiating against yourself on the thing that matters the most, and that is Iran never being able to obtain a nuclear weapon. Because as bad as what they're doing in the region is now, if they had a nuclear weapon, their ability to project power and to deter our actions and our allies and partners' actions would be profound. So why would you have a negotiation where you would negotiate trades between a nuclear program and other issues? We needed to get the nuclear weapons off the table. All of the sanctions remained on their ballistic missiles, on their arms dealing, on their human rights, on what they are doing in the region. And quite frankly, our efforts to get Americans who still remain in Iran, detained and missing in Iran, we need to have that part of our negotiating frame going forward as well. There are ways one can do that, but if you have them all on the table, one gets negotiated against the other, and that is not in our national security interest.
Do you have any sense that the Europeans are willing to keep going forward in what seemed to be clearly not a real process?
The Europeans have been quite stalwart in the last few days, saying that they want to try to keep the deal together without the United States. I think that's going to be very difficult to do. I applaud them for trying because I believe that the deal is in our national security interest. You know, at the end of the day, this is about what will keep Americans secure. And for the life of me, I've never figured out how allowing Iran to go back to enriching uranium and trying to get weapons-grade plutonium to build a nuclear weapon is in our national security interest. But somehow the president seems to believe that it is. And John Bolton's becoming national security advisor. Secretary Pompeo, although I think he wants to now try to be a diplomat, he is still a hardliner when it comes to Iran. And it appears that the president may lead us down a path toward conflict with Iran, war. That is not a good outcome for the United States. And in the short to medium term, Iran turning back to the possibility of getting a nuclear weapon is certainly not in our national security interest. So quite frankly, none of this makes any sense in terms of America's security. It only makes sense in the sense that the president said he was going to do this.
So have you kept up with the Iranians that you spent months and months locked in a room with?
I have. You know, when you make diplomatic relationships, you don't give them away. And so I have, as many Americans have, seen Foreign Minister Zarif when he's been in the United States.
And he was just here right before President Trump's decision.
He was. And I did see him. And, you know, when I see him, I represent as a patriotic American that he should do whatever he can to stop the malign behavior in the Middle East, that it doesn't help to hold on to this deal. That he should continue the compliance to the deal, which the International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed 11 times is the case. So, you know, when we see foreign leaders, we are true to what is in America's national security interest. This isn't about politics. This is about our security interest.
Well, of course, look, Wendy, I mean, unfortunately, it's become so politicized that even a conversation is now interpreted in different ways depending on which team you're on. But I'm interested in the putting aside the politics. You saw Javad Zarif. You've presumably talked with other Iranians as well in the run-up to this. What are they telling you? What do they make of it? Did they have a realistic assessment, in your view, of President Trump?
I think they had a realistic assessment, but and we've seen enormous diplomacy just after this decision. Foreign Minister Zarif went to China, went to Moscow, met with the European leaders in Brussels, along with the European Union. Certainly, Zarif is nonstop in trying to find a way forward here, but I want to make sure to make one really important point. National Security Advisor Bolton has said that the Iran deal had to end because even though the International Atomic Energy Agency said there was compliance, that he didn't believe that it was infallible compliance. And I would say to National Security Advisor Bolton, how in God's name can any verification and monitoring North Korea be infallible?
I can't think of almost anyone else who would have this unique set of experiences in the room, intensively in the room, with both the North Koreans and the Iranians. You and Secretary Madeleine Albright actually traveled to Pyongyang, and you met this current Kim Jong-un's father, as part of that. At that time, you are Secretary Madeleine Albright's counselor. You are a very close advisor to her. You two are still working together all these years later today. So is there a North Korean style of negotiating, and is it different than the Iranian style of negotiating?
I see North Korea's approach to negotiations is pretty transactional. And in that way, they're a little bit like the president, in that everything is possible or up for sale and up for leverage. Iran is a very complex negotiator. They are a negotiator of resistance, which is the mantra of their country, just as in North Korea, the mantra is juche, which is self-reliance. And one has to understand those cultural frames for negotiations. Iranians are superb negotiators, very tough, very patient, see all the pieces on the table. And so it is a very complex kind of negotiating style, somewhat different than the North Koreans.
So, Wendy, how do you see this hitting the Iranian economy? And will we ever be talking directly to Iran again?
I certainly think it'll have an impact on the Iranian economy. It's interesting, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is so responsible for what is happening in the Middle East and Iran's presence in the Middle East, was never for the Iran deal because they had the corner on the black market when sanctions are in place. So I think they will be ecstatic that now all the gloves are off. Rouhani's trying to keep the deal together. I call Rouhani the hardliner, and I call the IRGC the hardliners. So I think the hardliners are going to win out here. That's not good for the future of Iran. That's not good for the United States. And that gives me great concern and great pause.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Wendy Sherman.
Thank you, Susan.
Wendy Sherman now works at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Susan Glasser writes about Trump's Washington for us every week, and you can find her work at newyorker.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.